It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here, as always, live and in color, in the studio on this sort of nice-ish Saturday. Not what Florida is known for necessarily, but after being cold for so many weeks, I'm kind of liking this a little bit. So if you want to go outside today, you might not wind up getting a sunburn, but, you know, even with a little overcast, it's still possible.
It's just every weekend. The weeks are nice, and the weekends, you just can't win.
This week, wow.
Yeah, it was beautiful, but it really now. Was. Mm.
Well, that's called Murphy's Law, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Makes sense. Anyway, all the regulars, welcome back. Thanks for always being there. We need you, of course. And if you're listening elsewhere, including on the internet, which we're still having problems with again, the garbled and buzz and all that hasn't been worked out yet. So we got it fixed last week. Hopefully get it fixed again this week. But other than that, radios or whatever, welcome. And we're having some trouble just on the basic internet, but there's some other things too, I guess. Anyway, try to stick around the whole time if you can. And if you are new to the show and have never heard it before, I hope you're coming in loud and clear and can appreciate it enough to stick around for the whole hour, because we would like to have you get accustomed to sitting around. You're the reason I open the show every week. It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. I want every time you think of Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, I want you to think you've got to turn on this program. This is not an accident. We don't do a lot of marketing. Obviously, this is pretty much it. So you'll learn something, hopefully, and you can always get hold of us through the internet without any static at VanWeeFinancial.com or call the office or whatever. We are certified financial planners, fee-only fiduciaries, members of NAPA, and so on and so forth. It's a rather small company. Two out of three of us are sitting in this room today. But that means it's very personal, too, and what we specialize in, among other things, is a personal touch for everybody. Plus, Adam and I deal with people together, so you don't get only one person when you go in. We call it the twofer system. You get twofer.
Yeah, and you get two different perspectives mm-hmm. as well. One from a
age difference.
Yeah, one from a middle-aged Gen Xer and one from
and the other
a
one
boomer.
From you.
Yeah, something like that.
I guess that's not what he meant. Oh, well, enough of that. As always, lots to talk about on a Saturday morning, including what an unusual week. And I've always tried to just sum it right up, and all I could think about this week is not looking good.
But
and
it wasn't
it ended up.
But it wasn't bad either. It was just kind of.
Nobody was happy. The news was largely good.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, and nobody cared.
No, it was
until 2:30 yesterday.
It was just the Nasdaq in particular lately has just been under pressure. The growth trade has not been in favor. Dividends have been much more popular. Value plays, and it's just every morning you wake up and sometimes the Nasdaq futures would be negative, the Dow would be positive, or everything would be positive.
By a lot.
And by the time the market opened, the Nasdaq would have flipped negative. Mm-hmm. So. It just has been under a lot of pressure. I personally don't agree with that. I think that tech earnings in the second quarter are going to be very good. Just a prediction.
It'll be astounding.
It kind of surprises me, but interest rates are what is driving it.
Yep.
It's kind of unusual. But the last minutes of the day on Friday really saved us. It saw a huge buying surge, lifted the S&P and the Dow solidly back into the black for the week. And the Nasdaq fell just short of positive territory, losing 0.6%, so really pretty flat. For the year, all three indexes are positive. The Dow has gained the most at 8.1%. S&P is just behind that at 5.8%. And the Nasdaq still holding on to a small gain for the year, 1.9%.
Yeah, the Dow and the S&P are at all-time records, which was a very quietly announced thing after the market closed.
You would not have thought it if you followed the market this week. And so the 10-year Treasury, I mentioned interest rates before. The 10-year is the one we look at the most often. It closed just under 1.7% yesterday, so it was down for the week, although it did rise Friday afternoon along with stocks, which is kind of the opposite of what has been happening recently. But it was down for the week, so that gave a little bit of a boost. Mortgage rates fell as well from 3.3 to 3.2%. So rates backing off their sort of recent highs. I think that I don't want to say we've peaked, but I want to say that this is probably close to the peak. I don't think that the 10-year is going to go much over 2%, and if it does, I think it pulls back pretty sharply. So I just think we're getting ahead of ourselves with the Fed just adamantly saying that they are not going to move. I just think that it's ahead of itself. So most sectors on the S&P rose this week, with the exceptions being communication services, which fell almost 4%, and consumer discretionary, which posted a very slight loss. Consumer staples posted the largest gain of almost 4%, followed by energy and utilities at almost 3%. Markets around the world were under a little bit more pressure than the U.S., and Brazil dropped the most at 5%, just really got hammered, and a handful of European markets dropped by about 0.5%. The lone bright spot was Australia, gained 1.5%. Commodities index dropped a little bit. The silver posted a nice substantial loss at about 4%. Gold and oil were down more than 0.5%. Natural gas gained just under 2%. And the fixed income market finally had a positive week, with rates dropping slightly. And even long treasury saw gains of almost 1.5%. They've been nothing but negative lately. So a little bit of a bright spot there.
And rightly so, with rates climbing as they have been.
Yeah, you knew it was coming.
Yep.
If you go back to 1 year ago from this week, things were not looking very good in the markets. The pandemic was just taking hold in the U.S. The country was being put on lockdown. Everyone was freaking out, basically. From 1 year ago, the S&P is now up 75%, NASDAQ's up 85%, and the Russell 2000 is up 125%. Those 1 year ago charts right now look really crazy.
Yeah, the Dow wasn't quite as good as any of those, but the numbers are interesting for all the reasons that the Dow is interesting, the numbers are big. We're at 33,073 right now. A year ago today, it was 21,637.
So a gain of 12,000 or so.
Yeah.
That's
12,000. That's 1,000 a month on average,
yeah,
over 12.
That's right.
That's just mind-boggling.
There have been years where I don't think that the Dow gained 1,000.
Right.
So that is pretty crazy. It's not surprising. So my point of bringing that up was just to say that it's really not surprising to see a sideways trade right now. And it's been like that for a few weeks. I would not be surprised to see it a few more. You need that consolidation phase going into it. And I think it's especially healthy going into an earnings season that I think is going to be fairly good. That means that some things are going to look like relative bargains during the next quarter. So keep an eye out for that.
And if you look at where the trends are going, I always like the Google search trends. You're seeing airlines,
vacations, boats. Yeah.
So I think people are really looking forward to getting their communities opened up again.
Oh yeah,
going places, doing things.
It's like record levels of those types of searches for this time of year, and this time of year is when those things start to get popular anyway. But this year, they're already popular, well ahead of when they should be.
Yeah, and it's a good thing because we still have 9.5 million less working people than we did.
But there's some good news there too. I'll talk about it after the break.
All right, I'll take you up on that. We've got a doozy of a trivia question today for after the break, and this is one where I'm going to save Ken Bale some money because nobody will get it. That's what I think. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we were wrapping up the market, but before that, we have a trivia question sponsored as usual by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Now, there's a lot of talk about green energy and lack of pollution and all that going on right now because of the change in administration. So I've got an interesting question about emissions. What entity, carefully consider that word, what entity produces the third most emissions in the USA? And I'm going to tell you what the first two are, just to get you thinking. Number one is ExxonMobil. Number two is the federal government. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What is number three? If you get this, I'll make Ken send you something.
Sounds good.
What a deal.
That is a good deal.
A couple more add-ons to the market Adam wanted to touch upon.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about, there wasn't a lot of economic data this week, but there was a little bit. It was kind of interesting. One metric we like to keep an eye on, bullish sentiment. Bullish sentiment recently moved up to over 50%, and you would think that would be a good thing, but you would be wrong. This is for individual investors, and they get it wrong more often than not. So if this reading remains elevated, we're probably in for a little bit of pain in the short term. Doesn't mean it will stay elevated. It could reverse. It moves around a lot, so we'll see what happens. There were some mixed results in the economic data, but the one really good point was real GDP growth was revised upward from 4.1 to 4.3%. That's an annual rate. It beat the estimate, and the growth was mainly due to business investment and consumer spending. So two areas that you really like to see pull up GDP because they're both very positive for the economy. Net exports was the biggest drag on that number. And then initial and continuing jobless claims both hit post-pandemic lows this week. Initial claims fell 97,000 to 684,000, and continuing claims fell 264,000 to 3.87 million, the first reading below 4 million since the pandemic. So that's really good news.
Would have thought all day Thursday it would have been just a bonanza out there, but it wasn't greeted that way.
No, it wasn't. I think it was expected. These numbers have been trending this direction for quite a while, and to be honest, they've been leveling off a little bit. The rate of decrease hasn't been as rapid as it was just a few months ago. So I think that I think we really need to get the rest of the economy open before we see the real big gains come again. One interesting data point this month was home sales. Both existing and new home sales declined by a good amount in February, but there were good reasons for it. I think the housing market is still on fire. I know that Angela and Howard tell us that in Jacksonville that is definitely the case, and anecdotally there are so many stories out there right now about multiple offer situations on the first day over asking with cash buyers, and it's a zoo out there. Inventories are low and prices are rising, but new home sales declined 18.2% in February, but they're still up 8.2% from a year ago. So that 8.2% number is a really good number. 18% down is not a great number, but new home sales are counted when contracts are signed. That means that the February numbers were pretty depressed because of the polar vortex across the middle of the country. So February also has less days, so there's just less time to execute those contracts. But I really think the weather was the biggest factor there. Existing home sales are actually counted when the home sells, so that number was affected much less than new homes, and it only dropped 6.6%. That means that most of those contracts were probably signed in December and January. So there was just that weird weather pattern we had really affected the new home sales. I would look for those numbers both to rebound in March.
I think you're probably right. Weather can play, big bad weather can play a huge role. And when you affect Texas, you really affect America.
How many, just Dallas, Houston, Austin have huge population centers, all of them. And when you take those out of the equation for a week or more, that's going to have a big effect on the national numbers. Yep.
Well, it's almost April, which means, of course, everybody's thinking taxes. And for those people that were the most affected by that storm, being Texas, with also parts of Louisiana and Alabama, I believe, have gotten an extension similar to last year. If you remember last year, April 15th didn't happen. Well, it did, but nothing happened. But it had been moved back to July 15th for the whole country based on the pandemic. That included such things as the quarterly payments that were due for the year that is now our last year's tax form. So nothing really had to happen on April 15th. And a group of House members wrote to the IRS and asked them, please, to extend everybody. So it's government. Think about it this way. A camel is a racehorse designed by a government. I altered that a little bit for the purposes, but anyway, naturally, being government, they feel this need to, quote, do something,
of course,
whether it needs to or not. But then again, if they can do something and really mess it up, you can count on them. So all of you out there, except those who are in the affected areas, but everybody else in the country now has dispensation to May 15th. And, of course, May 15th being a Saturday, they changed it to May 17th. So your taxes aren't due until May 17th. Isn't that wonderful?
It's good for me. I owe a little bit, so I can just put it off another month.
If you're talking about last year's money, yes. Because the other thing they messed up was if you owe anything for last year for 2020, that is not due until May 17th. But if you are a quarterly filer, Forms 1040 ES, that is still due on April 15th.
But that's for the current year.
That's for current year.
Yeah.
But most people don't know what they're going to be paying this year until they understand what affected them last year.
That is true.
That's why I don't like what they did, because it's requiring you to have information that you do not have. You have to guess. If you want to stay out of trouble, there are two safe haven ways to do it. You can pay 100% of what you owe this year in those quarterlies, but you, of course, don't know that yet. Or you can pay 110% of last year's total tax liability, which you won't know either if you extend out to May 17th. So you can take either one of those impossible pieces of information and add a bunch to it for safety.
But there's a caveat there. You can prepare your taxes and figure all that out not file.
Except a lot of
which
people
is what
like
done.
To do it. Yeah. A great way to do it, do you use tax Intuit or
no, I have an accountant.
But for estimating?
No, I had her prepare it. I gave her all my stuff early, and she came back, and I said, just don't file it. We'll hold off until the deadline.
Okay. Well, another thing, a lot of people don't use a CPA or other preparer, and if you go into TurboTax, something like that, they don't require you to pay them anything.
No, you pay until when you file. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you can
go through
estimate.
In fact, you can go in and open up two files. You can do the last year that you have with you and put in all those numbers. Then you can estimate again and estimate again. You get a pretty good idea where you are. And then all you get is one email about every 3 days saying, it's time to file.
Yeah, and it is pretty annoying.
they do not leave you alone.
No.
There's no doubt about that. But the point is, if you're concerned about it, and what I'm mostly talking about is if something has happened in your life, if you've taken a new job, gotten a raise, went back to work, or any of those things where you're going to find yourself in a vastly different circumstance, then you have to be very, very careful about how you play the 1040 ES game. Now, if you earn wages and get a W-2 and have withholding that's adequate and all that, you can ignore all that. But there's an awful lot of us out there that don't do that. Now, there's also a government push to make us all do that, but that is not what I'm talking about today. I'll save that rant for another day. There's so many things now. All the stuff that's going on is, in any rational person's mind, inflationary.
Yes.
You cannot create $1.9 trillion. Then create another, I've heard estimates from 2 to 6 trillion.
Yeah, I think 3 and change is what I've heard most.
Yeah, you can't do that. The money supply is already up 26% for last year.
Wow.
Now, if you are any kind of an economist, as I am, I'm any kind, meaning I don't have a degree in it, but I do have a minor in it, and I've been practicing a long time. If you understand the monetary theories of people like Milton Friedman, you know that inflation is and always will be a monetary thing. When you create 26% more money than you had last year and you don't offset it somehow, you can expect up to a 26% boom in inflation. Well, as you also know, we are lied to. The sheeple in this country are lied to all the time by places like the CBO and the Federal Reserve and so on and so forth, a Bureau of Labor Statistics, a Bureau of Economic Analysis. They will all tell you inflation is moderate, under control, and no problem. Now, they're starting to admit that they have a little crack in that, but maybe it'll influence things down the road, but it'll be temporary. I have in my hand, this is one of the few times I wish this were on television, I have a graph, an XY graph, with a blue line on it that runs all the way along the bottom until it turns almost straight up. And it's the measure of inflation since this country was founded. And right at that inflection point, there's a little thing that says, 1913, creation of the Federal Reserve. Now, you all know my feelings on that, I'm sure, after many, many years of listening to me. And I'm not going to dwell on it afterwards. So we'll get on to more fun things. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I want to remind everybody that the trivia question is still out there. What entity is the biggest polluter, meaning emissions, in the U.S. after, number one, ExxonMobil, number two, the federal government? What entity is third for emissions? All right, Adam has another entry in his running series here that I like to call, Who Am I? It's actually not correct, but that's what I call it.
Yeah, this is Millionaire Number 5. And this segment is about realizing the American dream. The people that I've been talking about grew up in less than ideal circumstances. A lot of them were either the sons or daughters of immigrants, basically came from nothing and made something of themselves. And it's pretty cool. I've learned a lot by researching this stuff.
And, I can and imagine.
Some of the stories are just really, really great. So, and this one's no exception. Our millionaire number 5 was the second son of an Italian immigrant father and a Greek immigrant mother. This billionaire, now billionaire, was born in Los Angeles in 1944. His parents divorced by the time he was 2 years old, and his single mom was unable to support two children, so the kids were sent to an East LA foster home to stay during the week, and they finally were able to return home at age 9. That is when his entrepreneurial spirit started. He and his brother started selling Christmas cards and newspapers to make extra money. He graduated from LA District Public Schools and went on to join the Navy for 2 years. From there, it was a series of low-paying jobs, including janitor, insurance salesman, door-to-door salesman for a variety of products, and finally hired by a couple of hair care lines to rep their products. Like many of our entrepreneurs, he ended up getting fired from that job. During that time, he was also living in his car, so things were not looking very bright early on. So he went out and found a loan for $700, and he and his friend Paul Mitchell started their own hair care line, which ended up doing pretty well, as you may have guessed. Paul Mitchell Inc., despite the unexpected death of its namesake, Paul Mitchell, in 1989, does hundreds of millions in sales today. With his newfound success, he went on to make several other lucrative investments, including co-founding Patron Tequila, the House of Blues music venues, and a few energy companies, a Harley-Davidson dealership, and a boat company. The entrepreneur has also made a guest appearance on Shark Tank and is actively involved in producing movies and has even acted in some small parts. He's been married to the same woman since 1993. They have a daughter. He's donated politically to both sides of the aisle and has a charitable side as well. He co-founded Grow Appalachia in 2009 to teach healthy eating habits and farming skills to children. He traveled to Africa in 2008 to help Nelson Mandela feed 17,000 orphan children. He supports Food for Africa, Mobile Loaves and Fishes, Mindseeker, and Blazer House, and even has a documentary called Good Fortune, which depicts his good deeds throughout the world, and it won an award at the Sundance Film Festival in 2017. So the son of immigrants from the son of immigrants to foster care to living in a car on the streets of L.A. to being worth $3 billion and having documentaries made about your work to make the world a better place, John Paul Jones DeJoria has lived a pretty amazing life. He is the co-founder of Paul Mitchell Hair Care Products.
Huh. Who knew?
Yeah.
I am very familiar with Paul Mitchell products. I see them when I take my wife into the salons and
yeah.
such.
Yeah, they're always there.
Yeah.
And there's a reason he's made so much money.
It's too bad Mitchell didn't live long enough to see what he had started.
Yeah, I mean, I think he got to see some success, but nothing like what the company has become today.
Oh, cool. Ain't that America? And speaking of America, what's more American than Costco?
It's pretty American.
Pretty American. Although there's some things I don't like about some of the people that started up. That's irrelevant. We are devoted. Anybody who knows us well knows that we are devoted Costco people and have been since the one opened out on Butler. Well, you know, they do some other things besides what you put in your basket. I don't know that everybody knows how many things they do on the side, but one of them I just found out a few things about, thanks to Clark Howard's site. Clark comes up with all kinds of good stuff. You know, if he's talking about it, it's a great way to save money, because that's what he does. Anyway, topic for this week is the Costco car rental program. Now, you can picture a Costco, and there are a lot of cars there, but they seem to belong to people who are shopping.
Yeah, I don't think you can rent those.
So one of the things that they do, they work with car rental agencies, so they don't maintain a fleet of rental cars. Now, when you think about that, think of the overhead that they don't pay, and yet they're getting the sales off of these things. It is astoundingly simple in concept, and execution-wise, they have apparently done a wonderful job. How do you do this? There's an 866 number, or they also have a Costco travel website. That's how you set them up. All right, what car companies do they subcontract with? Alamo, Avis, Budget, and Enterprise. Mm-hmm. Now, they're pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
How old do you have to be to rent a car through Costco? Well, there is no age limit, although some rental companies do limit it to 25 and above. Costco does not, but you will pay an extra fee. So you get a discount by going to Costco wherever you're dealing. And then after that discount, if you're under 25, there'll be an add-on for the additional insurance for that. But it won't stop you. Is it only America? No. Canada, France, Germany, Ireland, Spain, and the UK. You can book. So if you're going to travel somewhere and you want to set up a car, go to your local Costco or the Costco travel site and set it up. To cancel, you log into your travel account, select your current booking, click cancel, and answer yes. Tough, huh?
Pretty easy.
Yeah. And apparently the savings are substantial enough and the ease of use is substantial enough that it's growing by leaps and bounds.
Never would have guessed.
No, there's some other things too, and I'll be talking about some of those in coming shows. It just kind of blows me away when I see what they do that you don't really know about. Even though when you're walking out of there, there's some like kiosk poster things, but you don't really pay much attention to them until you find out what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
It is truly amazing. I got to give credit to these people. They are smart. They're kind of like Amazon, only in a much different regard. All right. Ever read a story that you know was done because of the narrative?
All the time.
All the time. Trying to make a point, and sometimes the narrative comes through loud and clear. Sometimes it's valid or largely valid or something. But very often, the end of the story misses the most important point because the most important point doesn't necessarily fit the narrative. I have one today, and it is called Women Advisors' Skills Questioned by Men Disproportionately, poll finds. Now, that doesn't seem all that hard to believe, since traditionally the financial advisor role has been male. Women in it are pretty new. But this one says women in the financial advice business are more than twice as likely to be questioned. So you're thinking, but maybe it's 50% or 60%, something like that. No. It is 13% of female advisors say they sometimes or often feel second-guessed by their male clients versus 5% of males.
That's such a misleading statistic, though, because if you feel second-guessed, yeah, that's very different than getting second-guessed.
Yeah.
I don't know. That meaningless is what it,
well,
what
exactly.
It jumps out to me.
Anyway, they go on as they're working through time here to find out that once a woman has been introduced into the business for a while, gathers a few clients, that all that goes away real fast. And now, fast forward to current times, a lot of people, particularly some women, I would imagine, don't know that one for sure, but a lot of people are asking for female advisors.
Oh, women make excellent financial advisors. In fact, we are hoping to have one on our team in the not too distant future. So,
and I know that some clients are very fond of working with women.
Yeah, in fact, seek them out, as the article mentioned.
Yeah, and we have a dramatic proportion of our business that is single females, most of them widowed or whatever, and some young up-and-comers. I'm telling you, young people, if you like math and you like money,
And you like people.
The three things you absolutely have to have, then I couldn't advise a better future for you. We'll be right back. This is the Vanwee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanwee.
And I'm Adam Vanwee.
And this segment brought to you by Robinson Landscape and Maintenance. You can call Troy at 904-662-9794 and let Troy do it, which is my motto and has been for several years now. A quick wrap-up on my presentation to would-be female financial advisors. And this one is very important, I think. This is a direct quote from a very successful female advisor. And I quote, "When I received my CFP designation, that seemed to stop."
Oh, good.
When you're qualified.
Yeah, well, that's just a confidence issue to me.
Absolutely.
I felt the same when I first started. It's impossible to feel confident when you are learning and not feeling like you know everything.
Yeah, if you pass a CFP exam, ask anybody.
That helps.
Ask anybody who's done it, and they'll tell you it's a lot. Ask a lawyer if the bar exam was hard. It's the same thing.
Yeah. In fact, I know that two of the largest RIA firms here in Jacksonville, which is the type of firm that we operate, are actually at least partially women-owned. So one is 100% women-owned, and the other one is a partnership between a man and a woman. So it's very common.
And I happen to know of both of those companies, and they are very successful.
Definitely.
All right. You had something you wanted to jump on?
I do. I have a little bit of a cautionary tale that came to me over a message board from a CFP in Arizona. And it has to do with Robinhood and day trading. And most of you have probably heard the story of Alex Kearns, the 20-year-old Robinhood investor that committed suicide when he misunderstood his account balances. And he thought he actually owed more than $700,000. He was mistaken. He did not. It was just something about the way that the numbers were presented. But really tragic story. And I hope that Robinhood has taken note of that and maybe done something about that situation. But I don't know that if they have or not. This story is a little bit different. The CFP had a young person.
We're going to
have a call.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. How are you today?
We are excellent. And you?
I'm doing fine.
Great. What's happening?
I wanted to ask a question concerning these changes in the 2020 tax codes. Has the deduction for fiduciary charges by advisors been changed where it's not a deduction anymore?
I got it. Add the disclaimer before I say anything else. We are not tax preparers nor CPAs. On the other hand, you're talking about our fees, so we're pretty knowledgeable. So, has it been changed? You mean after it was eliminated or before?
Yes.
So that happened a few years ago.
When they made these tax changes, I guess in the last year or so, various things were changed. And I would say the average citizen does not know, is not aware of whatever. And someone told me this week that was one of the changes that were made, that you can no longer deduct that from your tax return.
That was actually made in the Tax Act of 2017.
That's correct. Yeah, it's been like that for a few years now. And it really hit some people pretty hard because advisor fees can be quite substantial, and they were deductible and itemizable back prior to that. And it was one of the few of the people we have seen whose taxes actually went up in 2017 because of that. Most of them have been because of that reason.
Right.
Yeah, or would that also be applicable to, like, anything that's, I don't know, research subscriptions that you take and things like that are related to finance? As far as
those are not directly fees, so I would estimate, and I would tell you to double-check with a professional, I would estimate that those are still as deductible as they used to be. Now, that said, most people aren't itemizing deductions anymore.
Right.
That makes it very rare.
Yeah.
Which I think is a good argument for restoring the deductibility of RIA fees for everybody, because only a few people are actually going to claim it, and those people are being discriminated against, in my humble opinion, right now. So there is a movement. There are some people in the Senate and in the House who want to restore these.
And there's lobbyists working on it as well.
Right.
But so far, they have not gotten any traction, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe in the infrastructure bill they'll do that. Oh, wait, that won't happen. Actually, the place I'm thinking that it could happen, there is a small, by D.C. standards, bill going around right now that is aiming to change the required minimum distribution date up from its current 72 up to 75. And I think they're going to have to act on this year, or it's going to be too complicated. Now, if they were to slide it in there, we could all do a hallelujah. Mm-hmm.
The one thing working against it right now, though, Jim, is that the advisor fees are largely seen as something that rich people pay. And so that is not in favor. To restore money to rich people right now is very much out of favor. So I don't think it has a lot of headwind in the current political environment.
Yeah, but if somebody's clever enough to slip it in, it could pass.
Right. Well, from a standpoint of, based on what you're saying of what they're calling rich people, they could have if your income level was such and such, anything below that would be deductible. Anything above that, it would not.
That I would be on board with that, too. But
the way they approach that is they could have a maximum deductibility level of 28%, which they're working on now for people with $1 million incomes. So there are ways where we might see this again.
Yeah, I hope that does happen. But and if it does, we'll certainly report on it.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Great question.
Thanks. Appreciate your help.
All right, wonderful question. Thank you.
I have a few more calls lined up.
Good morning, Bosco.
Morning. I really didn't want to call in because you guys have some fabulous, juicy stories, and you just started one. I'm serious as cancer. I just wanted to take a stab at this, and then quickly the call before. But anyway, let me get going here. That word entity is such a big word.
Yes, it is.
Questioning, you know. Uh-huh. And I'm thinking the farming industry, agricultural industry.
I can understand that, especially the cattle farms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about emissions.
A lot of, don't light a cigarette behind one of those.
No. They are probably on the list, but they are not number three.
Good to go. Well, I'm going to get off, and I want to hear a story.
We appreciate your call. Thanks.
All right.
Good morning, Al.
Yes, I got a question about short-term bond fund.
Shoot.
Mm-hmm.
If interest rates go paid about maybe 2.5, what's going to be the effect on the short-term bond funds based on what you already have invested?
So are you saying that short-term interest rates would go to 2.5 or the 10-year treasury would go to? Okay, so short-term rates rose.
Yeah, if the 10-year goes to 2.5,
okay,
what effect will it have on investments in short-term bond funds?
Good question. So the value of those bonds would drop slightly. They are not as affected by rates on the price side because they are short-term and by definition – they are going to return your money to you in a short amount of time. So rates don't affect them as much. And interest rates can move independently. So short-term rates really have stayed very low. And that's sort of the market saying that we are not out of the pandemic yet. Yes, but the longer-term rates are the ones that are moving right now. And that's the market saying that we will be out of the pandemic eventually. So the short-term funds are going to be much more dependent on the short-term rates, although you probably would see them tick up if the 10-year went up to 2.5%. So if you're sitting on a short-term bond fund right now, you're not making anything. I mean, they pay very, very little. And
yeah,
it might,
it's not very much.
Yeah, it might pay a little bit more if that were to happen, but you might see a short-term decrease in the price. But I think that would return to its original price in within a short period of time. So I think overall it would be good for short-term bond funds because they would pay a little bit more, and everyone wants to find that safe yield right now. And so if there were an option to make some money in a short-term bond funds, I think you'd see a lot more money pouring into them than you are today.
Yeah. The beauty of holding your bonds in a fund is that the fund is constantly maturing issues and buying new ones. So if the new bonds that they're buying are recently issued, they're going to carry a higher coupon rate and they'll be less effective.
Yeah, that's true. You're right about that. Okay.
All right.
I just want to get some kind of professional advice here.
Great question.
We appreciate the call. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you much.
All right.
Out of time. I'm going to have to talk about the Robinhood Trader next week. It's
we'll
a good story and a very good cautionary tale.
And I warned everybody that this was not going to be one that you were likely to win. Number one, ExxonMobil. Number two, the federal government. Number three, Bitcoin.
What?
I am not making this up, people.
Okay.
Does it make sense to me? No. But I thought I'd pass it along. Number four, American Airlines. Number five, ConocoPhillips. Bitcoin?
For all the servers that have to be
used
to mine
it, exactly right.
I guess.
That's what it is.
Electricity.
All right, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. This is the Banway Financial Hour.